The University of Detroit Mercy presents an encore presentation of a classic Ask the Professor program. Today's show takes us back to September 2005.
The University Tower chimes ring in another session of Ask the Professor, the radio show where you match wits with University of Detroit Mercy professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your host, Kathy Bush, and today we have the Big Three with us. How appropriate for Motown. So let me start with the first member of our panel who is like so busy and can only stay for a little bit and has to fly. From the pre-college engineering programs over in engineering and science, it's Dan, the Dapset Man Maggio.
Hi, Kath.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Good. Sitting next to Dan, also from engineering and science, but from the Department of Mathematics, it's Professor Jeff Boats.
Thank God this building has more available bathrooms than the UN.
That's thank God it does. But we don't have a Secretary of State to fill in for those bathroom breaks.
No, or to hand out the little towels in the bathroom.
That's right, absolutely.
That's Kofi's second job.
That's right, got to do something that way. Okay, and around the table to my left from the Department of Philosophy, it's Chair, but she will be paroled within a year. Indeed, it's Professor Beth Uljar.
Really?
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, although it's the discussion is interesting.
A girl can dream.
Nobody wants to do it.
She's leaving philosophy. She's going to be a bouncer.
That's right. Down at Max on Third. Yeah.
I was supposed to be a parole officer, according to those tests that we all took in high school that told us what we were supposed to be good at. That's what I was supposed to do.
Parole officer? Mine said shepherd or florist. I found hysterical because I've killed every plant that's ever come into my possession except those shamrocks upstairs.
I think my brother was supposed to be a mortician or something.
Ow!
Mine said you'd be good at anything that doesn't involve math.
You've got to be kidding
me. That was my lowest score.
Well, that's whack.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's like really stupid.
I don't take IQ tests seriously.
It's the reductio ad absurdum.
Well, this is the show where you can ask us about florists, shepherds, morticians, math, whatever you want. And if you stump the panel or don't stump the panel, not only will you get the Fabu t-shirt, but you will also get, we are reinstituting the tradition. Somebody play Pomp and Circumstance for me here. We are going to do the autograph photograph or the photograph autograph. So again, we'll be selecting a site on campus so you can not only see what we look like, but you can see the beautiful world of UDM right there. But you got to send us some questions to get into that beautiful world. So how do you do that? You may use our website and check out what we're doing there at www.udmercy.edu/ATP for Ask the Prof. Or send them care of the U.S. Postal Service to College of Liberal Arts and Education, University of Detroit Mercy, Post Office Box 19900, Detroit, Michigan, 48219. And what you hear in the background, we're trying to unwrap some banana bread.
Oh, God. I'm trying to be quiet.
And you're doing it very well.
Some good stuff.
Our first question before we return to some leftover ones comes from Michael Jason, the guy who sits behind there and keeps us all in order.
The new voice of God.
And he writes, Kathy, I'm looking forward to a new season of Ask the Professor, and a question for the professors, especially for Dan and Jeff.
Uh-oh.
It's a math question.
It wouldn't be aimed at me. Absolutely.
It must be solved without using paper or calculators. Just use your heads. So, see, for me, that would have to be use your heads and hands, Michael, okay? That'd have to do it that way. So, are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. Here goes. Take 1,000 and add 40 to it. Now add another 1,000. Now add 30.
I'm out of fingers.
Okay.
Add another 1,000. Now add 20. Now add another 1,000. Now add 10.
I know what that is.
What is the total?
I even know that.
5,000?
Nope. 4,100.
Yes, it is.
Well, I thought it was 5,000 too.
It is, Jeff.
Oh, it is. Oh, geez.
Mixing up the order is what makes it tricky.
Very tricky.
I
was caught.
Oh.
I was caught.
Was I caught by the order of operations?
He said, did you get 5,000? Way to go. Most of us do. The correct answer is 4,100. Don't believe it?
Sure.
He said, check it out with a calculator on paper.
No, I know what
he
I
said,
did.
He said, the brain sure knows how to play little tricks on us, doesn't it?
Yes,
but
it
so does.
Does
our engineer. Now, let us return to some questions that
Very
we had to stop in. Wasn't that cool?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
That was definitely cool. These are questions from Bert Tilley of Etowah, Alabama. You guys were doing great because remember before he wanted you to have 14 of 18 or 77.8%, as Jeff figured out. And so far, you only have three wrong, so not bad.
How many to go?
One, two, three more to go.
Oh, good chance.
Okay. This unit was named after a French engineer who developed a telegraph code more popular than the Morse code. Unfortunately, the unit is not standardized, but it is traditionally represented by 1 bit per second of transmission for computer modems. What is this unit named? So represented by 1 bit per second of transmission.
It's not a baud.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. All right, cool.
I wouldn't have.
I got it first.
Baud.
I haven't heard that used in
a long time. This word of German origin refers to a structure so integrated that it is more than the sum of its parts.
Gestalt.
Yes, indeed. And then finally, what deity's name means auspicious one? He is usually depicted with a blue neck around which is a garland of skulls or a serpent. He rides the bull Nandi and is the father of Ganesha. This Hindu deity has three eyes.
It's not Kali.
Not Kali, no. Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm out of Hindu deities.
Yeah, Kali and Ganesh were the two I knew.
Yeah. Mm-mm. It's Shiva.
Oh.
It's Shiva. You got exactly 14 of 18, so you passed. So, Bert, don't worry. We'll get you a t-shirt, buddy. And we love you, and we are glad you are on dry ground. Very glad that you are on dry ground, Bert. Now, this next set of questions comes to us from Lori Curtis of Woodhaven, Michigan.
Is she new?
Guess so.
I don't think I've heard the name before.
So. Cool.
But these are questions, she said, about the 1500s. Now, sadly, she does not give us any kind of like grading scale here.
Excellent.
So I was going to say these are our kind of questions. Mm-hmm. But they're about sayings or events from the 1500s that she thinks are somewhat traditions today.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Why did June become the month where most people got married? Why did June become the month?
Summer solstice.
Well, there's that, and I always assumed it was that, but she's got a totally different reason down here, which actually is probably a good reason.
Because the word June is derived from Juno, the wife of Jupiter.
Good, again, good allusion there, but this comes really down to some basic hygiene.
People are cleaner in June. That's when people took baths.
Exactly. Well, here it goes.
Because the water is warm enough to actually get in.
They took their yearly bath in May.
Yearly?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dan.
Well, bathing was dangerous.
Yeah. They yeah. Mm-hmm.
They didn't know about microorganisms. They would dump the waste in the rivers.
Exactly. So it said, since most people took their yearly bath in May, they still smelled pretty good in June. And that's another reason, she adds, why brides carried a bouquet of flowers that helped to hide any body odors, which is another tradition of why brides carry bouquets.
Interesting.
I thought it was just so florists could make money. That's what, at least when my niece got married, I thought that's what it was.
Cost an arm and a leg.
Now, to continue, she said, with the bath mode, how does the expression don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, how did that come into the lexicon?
Because people did it?
Yeah, it did. It could happen. But it had to do with how baths were done, the order of bath.
The baby was the last one to take a bath?
Yes, exactly. That's it, Dan. Okay. Baths consisted of a big tub filled with hot water. The man of the house had the privilege of the first bath, so his water was nice and clean. Then it was followed by all sons and men of the household, then women, and finally children. Last of all, they would bathe babies. By then, the water was so dirty, you could actually lose someone in it.
Lovely.
Well, what's that scene from Monty Python where they say, you know, how do you know he's the king? Because he's not covered in what? Because I'm sure it was definitely funkadelic back then. How did the expression, it's raining cats and dogs, again, an expression originated in the 1500s, come into our lexicon?
Did people used to throw the carcasses of dead animals on?
No.
Was there throw
them out windows like they would.
Picked up and dumped animals on a city?
No, this does have to do with something about the roofs of most houses.
Because the
at that
animals
time.
Would crawl up and then slide off?
Yeah, that happened. Okay, that's close enough. Houses had thatched. Yes.
Right.
They were thick straw piled high, but there was no wood underneath. So it was a place for animals to crawl into to get warm.
Classic.
So when it rained, it would become slippery. Animals could slip off the roof or slip through the thatch, meaning it's raining cats and dogs.
Got it.
Sure.
I don't know about you, but I am like so glad I wasn't alive in the 1500s. I'm really sorry.
Jeez, no kidding.
Just not. How did canopy beds come into existence?
To keep the cats and dogs from falling on you.
Well, I'll accept that too, because it said there was nothing to stop things from falling into people's houses because of the thatch, since there was no wood underneath. It posed a real problem in bedrooms, where other things, such as bugs, animals, whatever, could fall on your clean bed. So she would be hung over it to provide some protection.
Hmm.
How did the expression dirt poor come about? Again, originated in the 1500s.
Poor people couldn't afford soap and couldn't afford to bathe even yearly.
It has something even more intrinsic with their homes.
Dirt floors.
That's right. Ah. The floor was dirt. Only the wealthy had something other than dirt.
That makes sense. That's
how you do it. Now, she notes here that the wealthy had slate floors that could get very slippery in the winter when they were wet. So they would spread straw on the floor to keep their footing. But as the winter wore on, they kept adding more of it on there. They called thresh until you opened the door and it would start slipping outside.
The threshold.
That's exactly it. That's the next question. What term did this bring about? And it was the threshold, because it kept the thresh down when you'd open the door or anything that way.
These are good questions.
Aren't these? These are totally
sometimes
interesting.
It would have been interesting being a mathematician in that age if you were,
oh, no doubt.
If you were privileged enough to have the money to go to college and learn math and science, or what passed for it back then.
Well, yeah.
You'd be Descartes.
A person who understands basic high school beginning college calculus, if they were to transport back there, would be the greatest mathematicians of the age.
Really? Well, wasn't their chemistry then more like alchemy, though? It wasn't really chemistry, right?
Yeah. Well, chemistry was definitely, the 1500s was interesting because science and magic were sort of still intertwined, alchemy, astrology. One of the first uses of mathematics was to chart stars.
Yes.
And the medical doctors, they would never see patients. They would read star charts and say, the stars say they should drink this potion. And, you know, they would never go near the sick person because, I mean, God forbid, they might
get sick. Well, yeah, I was going to say, you could get pretty bloody sick. The expression, peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, peas porridge in a pot 9 days old, relates back to the 1500s in what way?
It's the order, and you'd first have it hot, then you'd have it cold.
That was the last time British cuisine was edible?
Actually, I'll go with Dan's. Well, I like Jeff's
that
too, though.
Be.
It's true that they did serve the first week of the meal would generally be hot. Since the poor could not afford meat, they ate mostly vegetables. So they would eat it for dinner, leaving leftovers in the pot to get cold overnight. And could be eaten cold in the morning and warmed up. Sometimes the food had been in the pot for quite a few days.
Right.
So that's how they got the peas porridge in a pot 9 days old.
Luckily, they didn't eat meat.
That's right. So while we think about that, taste treat.
It's an Ask the Professor flashback.
Indeed, that's right. On my right, from the Department of Religious Studies, in fact, the very chair of that department, Professor George Pickering.
Hey, pleasure to be here, as always.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
George, are you saved?
What makes you think that's any of your business?
You're good.
Now, see?
They're
telling you how the pros handle
it. It paralyzes all powers of retort.
It does.
Do it.
That's
George.
Bang. That's
how
it.
How to handle bad questions.
What a guy.
That's good.
And that voice you just heard, sitting to George's right, from the Department of History and the Assistant Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Directress, I guess that's the right word,
whoa,
isn't it?
Or,
well, the person who runs the Learning Center.
Top chick.
Yeah, top chick.
Top chick. There we go.
Professor Kathy Bush.
Hello, Edwin.
Hello, Kathy.
Tough chick, too.
Yeah, well.
No, but, you know, there is a story that reminded me of that exchange with Kathy. That Dwight L. Moody was a big revivalist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Bible College.
Yeah. Late 19th century. And he did walk up to a person on the street and asked him if he was saved one time, and the man said, it's none of your business. And he said, oh, yes, it is. And the man said to him, you must be Dwight L. Moody.
That's good.
Oh, dear. That's wonderful.
You're listening to an encore presentation of a classic Ask the Professor program recorded in September 2005, featuring the late Professor Kathy Bush as moderator on UDM's Ask the Professor.
Welcome back to Detroit's theme song for the rush hour, Life in the Fast Lane, indeed. But we're back with some questions from Lori Curtis of Woodhaven, Michigan. And these are questions about the 1500s, and they are really interesting. I've got to admit, these are very cool.
Old school.
Old, ancient school. And last time you got the question about peace porridge, hot, cold, and in the pot 9 days old, because obviously they must have ate it 9 days old. But sometimes visitors, or sometimes actually usually on feast days, it's noted that they could obtain meat, usually pork, which would make them feel that it was a special holiday. When visitors came over, they could hang up bacon to show it off. It was a sign of wealth, therefore, that a man could do something that a commercial about perfume said that women
bring
home the bacon. Exactly. And yeah.
I remember those ads for Anjali.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was the name of the perfume.
Never let you forget your man.
Okay. They would cut off a little to share with guests, which would mean what expression that's commonly used today about
chewing the fat
from the bacon.
Very good.
Yeah, I think that's pretty hip. That's really interesting. Huh. Tomatoes were considered poisonous in the 1500s, although this was not really the case.
Probably tomatoes, because they closely resembled belladonna.
Maybe that was it. But she notes here that
same genus.
It was a food with high acid content,
right,
of the tomatoes. But something that medieval people used would actually make them, that would kind of leach onto the food and cause lead poisoning, or, you know, lead poisoning death. So what were those tomatoes put on that would cause this?
Lead plates.
Not lead plates, but a type of something that was very common even in colonial America.
Not mercury.
Antimony? Arsenic?
No, this would be something that the plates were made out of.
Well, I thought a lot of them were made out of wood. Pewter?
Pewter.
There we go.
Yeah, so the pewter...
We'll get to the right metal
But I would have thought the belladonna thing, that the way that the plant grew, that they thought, uh-oh, it's like nightshade, look out,
we shouldn't be eating this. Yeah.
But I guess not. Now, bread was divided amongst people according to status.
Okay.
So workers usually got the burnt bottom of the loaf, guests got the top, and the family would get the middle. But the guests who got the top also created this term commonly used today to talk about the elite.
Upper crust.
Yep. The upper crust. Yeah, I mean,
I had no idea that that was the origin of that this is the origin of these expressions.
I wonder if this woman sitting in the questions is a historian.
All she writes at the end is, whoever said history was boring, educate someone. And I like that. I really like that salutation. I really do.
Well, she's refuting that old Sting lyric, history will teach us nothing.
Nothing, yeah, but it obviously doesn't. Now, this also deals with drinking, this next question, that lead cups were used to drink ale or whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination would sometimes knock the imbibers out for several days.
Go figure.
Yeah, because I bet that was some pretty potent ale.
Is this
ale
the origin
or
of under the table?
No, but it's the origin of the custom of holding a wake. Why is that a custom?
Wake as in before a funeral?
Wake as in a funeral, uh-huh.
Oh, to make sure that they weren't really dead.
That's exactly correct. That they would then put these people, lay them out on a kitchen table for a couple of days.
Oh, okay.
And the family would gather around eating and drinking and using the table to see if that person would eventually wake up or not.
Well, similar things, I think, led to the notion of vampirism in Eastern Europe.
Uh-huh. Really?
You know, people would be buried alive in these cheap caskets
a foot
underground. And they'd come alive, and sometimes they'd actually come back and, you know, be able to get through the earth and come out.
Sure, and probably want to go and kick
somebody's...
Bloody,
dirty wreck when they did it.
Oh, I bet.
Or wolves would sometimes go into the cemeteries and dig up the bodies and eat them, and that led to the notion of werewolves.
Werewolves of London. Aroo! Yes,
that
indeed.
That was such a great movie.
I love that film. I really did. Okay. England is old and small, and local folks started running out of places to bury people. So that's a nice little segue into this, okay? So how does the expression graveyard shift come into being?
Well, every now and then they'd take the bones out of the graves and bring them to the charnel house, where they would just put it in a big pile.
Yeah.
You know, and then they'd use the new, freshly dug up graves to bury the new people.
Okay. Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
That's not just English. They did that in France, too.
I was going to say, I know that's more, I thought it was a continental. I didn't know it was even restricted that way. When reopening coffins, 1 out of 25 coffins were found to have scratch marks on the inside. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine that? It would be so horrible.
So 1 out of every 25 people being buried alive?
I can't believe it's that low. I mean, I really think that is. So people began to use this to tie a string on the wrist of a corpse and tie it to this object so that someone who might be buried alive would be able to signal with
a
this object.
Or a rock or something?
Not in a bell?
A bell.
Yeah.
That's right. Therefore, it gave the expression, saved by the bell. Too bad Matt's not here for a saved by the bell reference.
Screech!
But also another expression that usually has been taken out of context to mean really looks like. What is that expression? This person is a blank, blank,
dead ringer.
Spinning image. Dead ringer.
Yeah. For whom the bell tolls.
Those guys are so clever.
No, but isn't that amazing? Well, again, there was no kind of...
send us more of those, Laurie.
Yeah, those were cool.
So excellent. I was going to say, those were really interesting. Mm-hmm.
Send us more questions about the Walking Dead.
Why it's not a good idea to store your corpses in the public water supply.
Probably not. That's right. Yes, Halloween is coming up. I love Halloween.
I have to teach.
You're kidding.
Halloween. Yeah. I can't give little candy to the ghouls and goblins this year.
Oh, no.
Makes me sad.
Couldn't you send them out on a math, see like how many caramels or something?
The
math scavenger hunt. Make them,
I'll probably give candy to my class.
I know. I always do that.
I buy candy every year because the very first time I moved away from home, I had my own apartment. I was 19. I hadn't had time to get to the grocery store, and I didn't have candy. Oh. And I had a ton of trick-or-treaters, and I just was so mortified to have to say, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have anything for you. So although I have not actually had anybody trick-or-treat at my apartment that I live in.
Really?
No. Which is funny, because there are a lot of kids there.
Yeah. No, you live in an apartment complex, don't you?
I have a attached condo.
Okay. Do kids come around trick-or-treat there?
Quite a few around the neighborhood.
I just don't get any. But I always buy the candy.
There are a few who are obviously not from the neighborhood just showing up because, you know.
True enough. Oh, gosh, yeah. I know one year when I house sat for Edwin up in Sherwood Forest, which is a pretty upscale neighborhood here in Detroit, there were kids coming by van load from other neighborhoods. And I just got so cleaned out that thank God Edwin had this huge container of pennies. And I thought, okay, well, here goes.
What else are you going to do?
And I just, like, started hitting their bags with pennies. And these kids thought they were dimes. So I'm like, oh, yeah. Thought, hey, they'll be well home and in their mom's van before they discover what's at the bottom of that bag.
Do kids still have the little orange cardboard trick-or-treat for UNICEF boxes? Don't you
I have
those?
I remember those, but I have not seen those in a long time. And that's why I'm thinking, I'm hoping this year for Katrina that maybe kids might think about collecting pennies or doing things that way.
Because that was like a yearly...
UNICEF,
that was just
absolutely.
As important as dressing up for Halloween was that you were trick-or-treating for UNICEF.
Yeah, that was kind of a fun thing. Well, our next set of questions deals about... trivia about history and historical events. And some interesting facts here. The shortest war on record was between Great Britain and Zanzibar in 1896. How long did that war last?
It was measured in hours, I think.
Not even in hours.
Really?
Not even in hours.
15 minutes.
Low.
That's too low?
Too low.
30 minutes.
38 minutes.
38 minutes, exactly.
Oh,
on the nose.
Okay.
38-minute war.
Got it. Jeff.
I gotta know.
That's what the difference between 15 and 60.
I mean, I gotta know what it was about. I'm dying now to know what you could fight over for 38 minutes.
You know what? You'd have to put 22 minutes of commercials to film.
You're
that
right.
War.
There we go. That's it. How silly of me. Okay.
War on NBC.
Or on NBC.
Get a sponsor. Budweiser would jump at this at half a second.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah.
Totally. At the height of its power in 400 BC, the Greek city of Sparta had 25,000 citizens.
Mm-hmm.
How many slaves did they have?
Far more.
Most of them.
Oh, yeah. Way far more.
Yeah.
Like 50,000? Double the population?
Try even more than that.
75,000? 100,000.
More than 100.
Wow.
Yeah.
200,000?
More than 200,000.
Wow.
I know. These people were some lazy folk, I'm telling you. 500,000 slaves.
I suspect the primary purpose of the slave was to go fight Athens.
Well, that, I mean, I'm wondering if the, that's if they're counting like soldiery, or if they're counting like the what would be their militia or whatever. As. Well,
almost everybody would be their militia. It was.
But I mean, think of that: 25,000 citizens and 500,000 slaves. I mean,
well, Sparta was the only civilization in history more war-driven than us.
Yeah, and they were they're crazy.
That would explain why. Now, when we say something is, that number of people would have allowed you to keep things extremely orderly and extremely disciplined.
I guess,
and none of them would.
And
have
hence,
anything.
Yeah. Spartan, right?
The yeah, there you go.
Description of,
but I just said the number is,
and
like,
they beat Athens. That was so wrong.
Astonishing to me. Most people know that the name of the B-29 bomber that dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima was Enola Gay.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the name of the B-29 bomber that dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki?
I don't know that one.
You know, isn't it? They get no props.
They called the bombs Fat Man and Little Boy.
That's right.
I remember that.
Fat Man and Little Boy, that's right.
Well, it was a decent movie.
It shows you, don't be number two, be first.
That's right. Be number one. Be number one.
I don't know. The Enola Gay and...
Box Car. B-O-C-K apostrophe S like Bach beer.
Huh.
Box Car.
Okay.
So I wonder who Bach was. I don't know.
No
but
clue.
Could
the
be
pilot?
Somebody. When do historians estimate that acupuncture was first used as a medical treatment?
This has got to be B.C.
No, it is
sure.
B.C.,
China,
totally.
Right?
And in China, it was a Chinese emperor,
like
Shen Nong. 600
B.C. or something, even
oh,
further back.
Oh, way earlier.
Wow, that predates geometry then.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, this is like Euclidean, super anyway. Old.
1,000 B.C.
Even more?
Wow.
2,500 B.C.
You're close enough, dog. It's 2,700 B.C.,
The world's oldest piece of writing isn't that old.
That's what I mean.
So how do they know?
I have no idea. I have no idea, but that's a good question for next time.
How do you
time.
Document events in prehistory?
Prehistory.
Yeah.
That's a good...
By the oral tradition. But let
presumably,
me say
yeah.
our panelists, Professor Boats.
Succumb to the pressure.
Professor Maggio, bye. And Professor Oljar.
Had a great time.
As we did having you all here. Now, this word from the University of Detroit, Mercy.
Email your questions to atp@udmercy.edu. Or you may fax them to 313-993-1166. Attention, Ask the Professor.
It's an Ask the Professor flashback.
Let's pick up where we left off. Who is the partner of the original Human Torch?
The Sparky. Human match.
No.
Sparky is right, isn't it?
No.
It's something like that.
No, he masqueraded as a snowblower. It's a brand snowblower. Name.
The brand.
The Toro.
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 Oh.
Toro.
Oh. Got it.
And both of them cried out, flame on! And they wanted to turn on.
Sarah has a wonderful story about flames.
Oh, yes, it was a story of Tennyson's youth and his mother, who her headdress caught on fire, and she telephoned for the butler and she said, James, I'm on fire! And he said, I'll get Amy right away. Because apparently it was the lady's maid's job to put her mistress out when she was on fire. Oh.
Different unions.
Ask the Professor is transcribed in the facilities of the Briggs Building basement on the University of Detroit Mercy's McNichols campus. Ask the Professor is produced, witnessed, technically directed, and totally pulled together by Michael Jason. And our executive producer is Dr. Vivian Dix. So until next week, I'm your host, Kathy Bush. Go St. Louis Cardinals! Our dean needs you.
And we're back next week with another edition of Ask the Professor, so please plan to join us.